Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for November the 19th. Coming up on this week's podcast, we discuss science on the top of Mount Everest with our special guest, Dr. Hugh Montgomery, genetics researcher, intensive care doctor, and mountaineer. Also in the show, we hear from science writer Philip Ball about the human herd mentality and the physical laws of society. Plus, cloned monkeys, another climate change report, and a new species of dinosaur. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. I'm Alok Jha. Did I tell you that before? This solipsism's truly awful. But here's the rest of your Science Weekly team. Ian Sample, the Guardian science correspondent here.
Hello.
And making a long-awaited return to the pod, it's environment correspondent and ladies man, David Adam. Say hello, David, and hello to David's fiancée too.
Hello.
Welcome, both of you, and hello too to Science Weekly producer Ben Green, who is in his rightful place this week behind a pane of soundproof glass as finally we get to use our new studio. Benjamin, press a button and magic up one of those stings, will you? Now, over the past 18 months, we've brought you a number of guests from around the world. We've spoken to everyone from Nobel Prize winners to air guitar champions, from flirting experts to astronauts. But while they've all done amazing things, none of them can lay claim to having climbed mountains and performed brain surgery whilst up there, at least not till now. Hugh Montgomery is a genetics researcher, intensive care doctor, skydiver, and occasional mountaineer. Earlier this year, he organised the Extreme Everest Project, and next month, he gives the Royal Institution's Christmas lectures. Hugh, welcome to the pod. Extreme Everest, everyone here in this pod at some point has written about it over the past few years. I think David was the first one to write about it when you announced that you were going to have a little bicycle set up on the top of Mount Everest to do research. Right. Tell us where on earth this crazy idea came from.
Well, it came from a marrying of our jobs, those of us that work in intensive care and cardiology and other areas of clinical medicine, and our love of mountaineering. What people don't appreciate very much is that lack of oxygen is quite common in patients. It can be because you've got rotten lungs, maybe as a child with cystic fibrosis or an adult with clots on the lung, for instance, or smoking-related lung disease. Or it could be that your heart doesn't work right, so you're a blue baby with a hole in the heart, or you're an adult with a heart attack that's not delivering the oxygen right. Or it could be that you're in intensive care, and your lungs and your heart have gone down, and all your small blood vessels are in trouble. So there's a real problem with oxygen delivery. And what's clear to us is that we have really not a very good idea how the body copes with that. So some people cope with it very well, and some people don't, and they fall to pieces and die. So if we could find out why that was, we might be able to find a way of helping children who, for instance, who are very short of oxygen, have a much more enjoyable life, and also to increase the survival of some of our older patients as well as our younger ones.
So you decided to send a bunch of doctors and mountaineers up to Everest to sort of get them into the position where they didn't have much oxygen coming in, just to test this stuff out.
Now, you're sounding rather cynical, man.
And I'm not cynical. I'm impressed. I'm just saying, I'm very, very impressed by the whole thing. So we're getting to the point where, I'm going to ask you to describe what you actually did up there. But before you do, I mean, how did this project sort of get off the ground? And did you think to yourself, we need to find out how oxygen delivery gets into, how low oxygen delivery affects people? So why not just simulate it on the ground, for example, in a chamber, for example?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you're right. What you've got to do, you can't look at patients is the problem, because whatever made them sick has made so many other things wrong that to tease out what's related to oxygen is near enough impossible. So what you need to do is take normal healthy people and make them very short of oxygen. And what you need to do for the sorts of work we were doing is take relatively large numbers. And that's the key to why Everest. You're right, there are chambers that you could sort of simulate the ascent up Everest, but they're very small and they're very, very expensive to run, and it's very hard. So you might get, it's been done before, five or six people in a chamber, probably the size of this room that we're sitting in now, which isn't big.
It's not big.
And to put them in there for 35 or 40 days all together,
you'd actually have death.
Throats. Yeah, and part of the problem is it's very unhealthy to do that too. So there's quite clear data that, in fact, it's not the same as environmental shortage of oxygen, probably because you're sitting in a small cramped room with a group of people together for a long period of time. And that only gives you N equals 5, which scientifically doesn't help you really crack it. We were using genes to tease out the mechanism of disease, and to do that you need larger numbers. Not huge numbers, but more than 5. And it works out, actually, much, much cheaper to take 250 people to Everest than it does to put those 253 in groups of 5 in chambers.
Those 250 people were volunteers who paid to go on this trip and to take part in this research. What did they have to do?
Well, there were essentially two groups. So the ethics said that, I mean, we wanted one group to go as high as you possibly can because the limits of human survival in low oxygen, coincidentally probably, are the summit of Everest. It's very, very unlikely that you could survive very much higher than
Everest. Intelligent designers might have things to say about that.
There you are. They might, actually. So we needed some people to go there, but our ethics was quite clear. Unless you were a mountaineer and a high-altitude mountaineer and a scientist and a doctor, you weren't allowed to take part in those experiments because they quite rightly said, unless you understand the risks of all of those, you can't possibly decide whether you want to go. So we had a smaller group, and this expedition, I have to say, right now is led by Mike Grocott. I was involved in the science of it, but Mike was the leader of the expedition. So he led a group to the summit, and nine people went there. We had a slightly larger group that went to the South Col of Everest, which is around 8,000 metres. And then there was a larger group, again, of scientists, doctors and clinicians at the base camp. In addition to that, there were over 200 normal, healthy volunteers, many of whom might be listening to this, who not only gave a check to get there, but a check to support the research and then their bodies to be tested. And they went through a whole mill of tests as they made their way up to Everest Base Camp from Kathmandu.
And base camp's about 5,500 metres.
Yeah, just over 5,300.
So that's the sort of level where there's about half the amount of oxygen in the air that we have at sea level, roughly, isn't it? Yeah. And I've been at 5,500 metres. It's hard to breathe. So doing experiments up there for them must have been quite tough.
Very, very hard. And I was on the preparatory expeditions to Choi Oyu doing experiments on the way up to 8,200. And you're right. It's these people are, you know, they deserve a big pat on the back. They are the heroes. It is not only hard work, but it's very, very uncomfortable. You're breathless anyway, and you're breathless walking up hills or going for a pee, but getting cycling to exhaustion on an exercise bicycle really takes quite some effort, and all credit to them. And exercising on a bicycle is only one of the things they had to do.
David, you got a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to know, the people who went to the summit, did you do experiments on them while they were up there, or did they just nip up there while they were in the area?
Just passing by, that's right. No, they all got experimented on in Archway, North London, so that was a true base camp, so that's, I don't know what the altitude of there is, a few tens of feet probably above sea level. And everyone was tested there, every single person went through tests there. And then they went up, got tested again in Kathmandu at the Summit Hotel, rather nice venue, and then from there on in all the way up. So they were all doing it. And then others, then through the Icefall, on the way up through the Western Coombe, South Col and Summit. And the highest experiment was an arterial blood gas, so a stab in an artery to draw some arterial blood to see how low the oxygen levels were. Because it's been guessed before, or scientifically calculated where they're likely to be, that we wanted to know what is the tolerance of human body to low oxygen levels. And we're not telling anyone what the answer is, but when it comes out, it will surprise people. It's a level that if I saw it in you on an intensive care unit, I'd be talking to your relatives saying, I don't think you'll see the night through. And yet this was someone who had walked up there, was able to do the experiment and then walk off again.
Ian, you've got a question?
How much does the oxygen drop as you go up in altitude? And what sort of things does the body try and do to cope with it, and other things that it's good at doing to coping with it, and then other things it just flatly fails on?
Well, it's interesting. The answer is we don't really know. The conventional explanation for tolerating low oxygen was that it was all down to delivery. So the idea was low oxygen levels go, so you breathe harder and your heart pumps more and your blood gets thicker and you grow more blood vessels around your
cells. You get more like blood cells. And
yeah, that's the idea, carry more oxygen, more vessels and more of the little sort of power stations in the cell, the mitochondria. So that was the story, that it was all about trying to get more in. And some of it's true. Certainly true that you breathe harder at altitude, and as you acclimatise, you breathe even harder. So that's true. But actually, the maximum amount of work your heart can do falls, doesn't go up. It gets less maximum heart rate, and the amount it squirts out with each beat falls. And although your number of red cells goes up, the number of blood vessels doesn't seem to go up. That seems to, if anything, doesn't really do anything other than stay the same. It might even fall a little. Mm. And the number of mitochondria in the cell, the little power stations, also seems to drop a little. So there was also a story that the hemoglobin that carries oxygen changed its characteristics and became more ready to give its oxygen up, and that doesn't seem to be true. So there's quite a lot of stuff that's myth. And it actually, intuitively, if you're thinking whether you're an intelligent design person or an evolutionary theory person, intuitively what I'd say is, if you're getting your power supply, your fuel supply cut off, what you wouldn't do is try to pump even more of that fuel to cells and burn it quicker. What you'd actually try to do is firstly switch a few things off, and then try to burn the fuel that you've got left much more efficiently. We think that's what's going on. It's a bit, well, let's put it like driving a car. You know, if I said to you, I want you to drive to Scotland as quick as you possibly can, you get yourself something with a sort of 9-litre engine, turbo power, fuel injected, you know, fill the tank and put your foot to the floor. If I gave you a cup of petrol and said, I want you to get to Glasgow, you'd switch the radio off, you'd switch everything off, the air conditioning would go, and you'd get a highly efficient car and you drive it steadily. Mm. And we think that's what's happening in the cell. If we could learn to tweak that, that would make a big difference. We know that there is that sort of tweaking goes on. Pregnant women seem to be more metabolically efficient because they're conserving fuel for a fetus. Starvation seems to do that, clearly, because you've not got enough food. You need to conserve the calories. And exercise training seems to do that. So if you get very fit, you learn to use the calories more efficiently. So you can't really experiment.
It's all a bit like quantum mechanics. Everything's slightly unexpected. But when is all this stuff going to be published? When do you start sort of releasing the scientific data? Because there seems to be quite a lot of genuinely interesting science coming out of this.
I think it's going to be extraordinary, I have to say. And the first piece of data we're just submitting for publication now, which is how low the oxygen levels are, and I'm sworn to secrecy, so I'm not saying what that is.
No,
I'll get killed if I do that. But the other stuff we're being very clean about. It's an absolutely colossal amount of data. So the people who generated that data are cleaning it to make sure it's the decimal points in the right places, loading it into databases, and then those databases will be locked so that we can't go back, because that prevents any sort of temptation by anyone in 10 years' time to start saying, oh, well, that seems to be an outlier, let's take that one away. And, you know, once the database is locked, we can't go looking. So the answer is probably next spring to summer.
Hugh, thank you very much. Now, you've kindly agreed to stick around for the rest of the show. Yep. So hold tight. We'll be asking Hugh some more questions in just a bit.
Hi, folks. This is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, your feedback on Steven Pinker's swearing, Michio Kaku's visions of the future, and why our Facebook group has something of the devil about it. Plus,
that kind of repulsive interaction between people can result in really quite a striking degree of regularity in the spacing of people. It's just what comes out from the collective behaviour.
We hear from science writer Philip Ball about applying mathematical models to social phenomena. First, though, here's a look at the rest of the science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days.
News check. Genetically modified plants which produce essential omega-3 fish oils could be the only way to ensure people get enough of these nutrients, according to a major EU-funded study called LipGene. The plants, which would be used as feed for farm animals, could increase omega-3 in human diets without adding to pressure on rapidly declining fish stocks.
Scientists have taken another step towards cloning humans after they created the world's first cloned monkey embryos. Using the same techniques to create Dolly the sheep, the team of researchers at Oregon Health and Science University successfully extracted stem cells from the embryos and grew them into heart and nerve cells.
Fertility clinics should defer treating obese women until they've lost weight through dieting, exercise or surgery. That's according to guidelines issued by the British Fertility Society. Under the recommendations, clinics are advised to begin treatment on severely overweight women only after they've reduced their body mass index to below 35.
And finally, a computer programmer from Gloucestershire has found evidence of a new family of dinosaur while he was picking through bones at the Natural History Museum in London. The monster, now called Xenopsidon pronicius, belonged to a previously unknown family of sauropods. It was about the size of an elephant and weighed as much as 7.5 tons.
David, Ian, thank you very much. Let's pick up on a few of those. Ian, tell me about this dinosaur. This is essentially the story of a computer programmer looking through some bones that were sitting in the Natural History Museum for ages, and he noticed, an entire skeleton? What did he notice?
Well, what I love about the story is that this is a guy who lives out in Gloucestershire, you know, west of Britain, doing a PhD kind of part-time. He's a computer programmer by day, just does his fossil work in the evening usually. He was spending a day in this is a sub-basement of the Natural History Museum in London, and it's just a darkly lit sort of grey-doored room with you pull the doors apart and there's just shelves and shelves of bones. And his PhD, as every PhD I'm sure, was completely tedious. He had to... he was charged with sorting out what we do and don't know about these dinosaurs called sauropods, one of the big three families
of
dinosaurs.
There's got to be a lot we don't know, surely.
There's an awful lot, but it's more specific than that. It was, what do we know about the dinosaurs that come from this huge slab of rock called the Wealden Supergroup, which sounds like a 70s band, but it's actually a massive load of rock under Britain and the rest of the continent, some of the rest of the continent. So he was sorting through all this stuff day in, day out. Basically, the past 5 years, he's looked at very little other than vertebrae of sauropods. So when he saw one that was looked odd to him, he immediately knew it was incorrectly labelled, hadn't been touched for 113 years.
What a genius.
Was dug up in Hastings, put on the shelf with the wrong label on it. He looked at it and said, that's not only a new species, it's probably a new family of dinosaurs. It's a new family of sauropods, meaning there are six instead of five now.
Correct me if I'm wrong. This was a tiny bit of one of the vertebrae. And from that, you've got, in the Metro and in even in our newspaper and others, huge images of incredible sort of vegetable-eating creatures. How on earth do you get from a fragment? I mean, I'm well able to be impressed. I mean, Hugh's already impressed me with what humans can do, but this is incredible.
The easiest way to do dinosaurs is obviously with shadow puppets. And there's only three kinds of dinosaurs, essentially. There's the ones that flap, and there's the ones that sort of do that with their little forelegs, T-Rex style.
That doesn't work on me, I'm afraid.
Well, I'm not doing really a shadow, but they're sort of those ones that go grr. And then there are the sort of Diplodocus type stuff, you know, sauropods, long neck, long tail, four legs, wander around eating vegetables. That's pretty much your sort of dinosaur groups covered. This was another type of sauropod, so it was the type that had a long neck, long tail, and a big body in the middle, went around munching leaves. So it's quite easy to show a generic version of that. Now, what he looked at this vertebrae and he said, it's definitely a sauropod because it has these huge air pockets in the vertebrae. And the air pockets were there, which actually lightened the skeleton, otherwise the damn thing wouldn't have been able to walk around. I mean, these things got up to huge tonnages. It's amazing they got around anyway. But there was also stuff going on with it, which was just completely new. A thing called the neural arch obviously takes the nerves, slopes forward. All of the rest go straight up or go backwards. There was other bits with bone struts that link to the rib cage, which are very different.
You're more excited about this than this man himself, I think. What do you make of this? It's a triumph of human ingenuity, isn't it?
I think it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, my five-year-old will be so terribly excited about this, because I have to say, if we can find the gene that's carried on the Y chromosome, the love of dinosaurs, you know, seems to kick in under the nappies, I think.
All young boys love dinosaurs.
They do, absolutely.
Bugs in space.
And bugs in space. Well, let's move on a little bit. I'm loath to leave that story, actually, but let's move on a little bit. Something a bit more serious, the idea of cloning monkey embryos. This was a bunch of scientists in America who managed to clone a monkey embryo from the skin cell of a male rhesus macaque. Hugh, how important is it that we have what they're going for, which is basically stem cells specific to an individual? They managed to extract stem cells specific to this particular monkey. The idea being that, you know, you'd be able to do research on it, work out what's wrong with it, and maybe even grow tissue. We've all heard about the potential of stem cells. How important is it that we can do this, and how important is this as a step towards that?
Well, I think my feeling is that stem cells are going to be very, very important. We've not yet really worked out what their place is going to be in terms of therapeutic use, and there'll be many trials that haven't really worked in trying to use them to create new tissues. But in theory, it would you know, allow regeneration of tissues that are otherwise irreparably damaged. Now, whether that's a way society wants to go is really an issue of an issue for society, not for medicine. We've got a population that's expanded from 5,000 years ago to, you know, 6 billion now and climbing, probably hitting over 11 billion. And whether we want to be going down to these incredibly high technology solutions to individual diseases and individualized medicine, when in fact that's probably going to be a relatively small part of the total human burden of suffering in the world, I don't know.
For scientists like you, though, I mean, when you hear about this sort of research, is it more exciting for you to have a good source of stem cells to understand disease and then find other ways of dealing with them? Or is it more exciting because you think, actually, maybe we will get to these technological solutions?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I don't work with stem cells, but the question, you're quite right, is whether it's the excitement of the process or the product at the end. And I think that's been an issue for science for a long time, that in fact, we all as scientists get engaged in what we find terribly exciting, and very often our eyes off the ball as to what we might get at the end. Now, of course, that leads you into ethically difficult territories, as we had with development of nuclear weapons and goodness knows all sorts of things that were unforeseen by the people who were engaged with enthusiasm in the early scientific process. I'm not sure how much of you know, I can't talk specifically about this group and their work, but overall in science of stem cell research, how many people's eyes are fixed on the goal of what they could achieve with it at the back end, and how much of it is incremental steps along the way that might help that goal be achieved, and whether it matters, you know, one's a step towards the other.
Well, Ian Wilmot, the chap who led the team that cloned Dolly the sheep, he was quite insistent when he commented on this research and saying that it's excellent, we should congratulate them, but to remember everyone that this is just research and this is a useful research tool. He was trying to damp down the sort of expectations that we were all going to write monkey clone, that means we're going to have organs in about 6 months, which is basically everyone did in the end, which is, I think, a problem for this area. Let's move on to another very important subject, climate change. David, the IPCC is going to publish yet another report. I don't know how long this is and whether you have to read every word of the thousands of pages. And you're going to Bali to read it. Am I getting this story slightly wrong, or is there more to it than this?
Well, let's just say that although the IPCC process does seem to be going on for an awful long time, I'm sure it feels a lot longer to those who have got to write these reports rather than just us who
2,000 scientists,
who get to
Nobel
read
Prize
them.
Winners.
They are now, yeah. I wonder, actually, if they're all Nobel Prize winners. Whenever I talk to a scientist involved with the IPCC now, I say, are you a Nobel Prize winner? And he always say, oh, I don't know, they haven't told us how it works.
Go on, so what's happening?
Well, this is, it's called, technically it's called the Synthesis Report. It was released on Saturday. I'm sure everyone remembers the IPCC produced three big reports earlier this year. That, if you add them up, they came to about 3,000 pages. And crucially, they were separate. One was about the science, one was about the impact, one was about what we could do about it. What they've done now is they've synthesized them together and they've cut it right down to just under 100 pages. So this is meant to be your cut out and keep guide.
Is it snappy?
To everything about climate change. Well, it's science, isn't it? So it's quite snappy.
What are they saying? Because one of the things that we always heard from the IPCC was they were always on the one hand, on the other hand, and this time they were with the reports of the impacts and so on, they were quite strong for them. And in the synthesis report, has are they even stronger?
Well,
what
no,
are they
because
saying?
The synthesis report is drawn from the same research. They haven't done anything different. And the reason the IPCC had take a stronger line now is because that's what the science says. It's not them making a judgment on it. They just reflect what the literature says. And that's all of the scientists doing research now say there's very little doubt about any of this.
Ian, you've got a question?
David, the IPCC process is all very sort of conservative, looks at all the stuff that's already published in the journals and they sort of pass it all around and decide what to put in their final report. But is there anything you can say about sort of what's come out since those original reports, you know, the latest science, which gives us any flavour of where things are going, you know, beyond what might be coming out in the sort of, you know, the future?
It's a good point because the cutoff was in late 2006, so it's almost a year, probably over a year, and there has been a lot since then, and it's almost all in one direction, that things are worse than we thought and things are worse than the IPCC says.
And is that not like a publication bias, that scientists just publish the negative results, basically? Because if would they, I don't know, is there any element of that, or are people just very confident that that's an objective view, you know, of the scientific work being done?
No, I think if you were a scientist and you carried out a study that said climate change, don't worry about it, it would be published all over the place. You'd probably get a Nobel Prize if you said it wasn't worth it.
I mean, I have to say, I think knowing a little of this process, of course, the IPCC process is a political process, so it's not the scientists synthesizing science and publishing it as a group of scientists. It's scientists synthesizing science and it being passed through a political filter. And I think the message from the scientists has been very clear and very strong for quite a long time. It's been dampened down previously. It's just very much harder to damp down this one, don't you think?
But David, why are you flying to Bali to read this report? Is it the sun and sea and...
No, I should read it on the plane. Yeah. So by the time I get there, I will know about it. No, it's the Bali is a separate thing, although it's related, of course. Bali is the latest in the United Nations annual negotiations on climate change. This is the same process that produced the Kyoto Protocol back in the mid-90s. We're now at the stage where we need a replacement for the Kyoto Protocol.
So this is the next thing, and so this is the beginnings of that discussion.
Yeah, this isn't going to do it, but this is what they're calling the roadmap. They've got 3 years to do it.
What does it look like? I mean, is it going to be as bitter as Kyoto was? What about the US and countries like Russia who'd refused to sort of sign Kyoto?
Russia did ratify Kyoto. That's why it came into force. So Russia, they have been throwing their weight around a little bit more in the previous couple of meetings, but the US are essentially a dead rubber because everyone knows that George Bush has only got another 18 months or so. So by the time 2009 rolls around, when this thing has to be signed and sealed, there'll be a new president.
Okay, and I'll just wind up this section. Hugh, our environment correspondent, is going to Bali and flying in a plane and things, but you didn't fly in a plane, even though you're preparing this mammoth trip to Everest. Tell us why.
Well, that was climate change, essentially. So I came across this climate change story, I suppose, in the late 90s, when, like everyone else, you read your paper in, or a paper in Nature and Science, and you look at the thing that's next to it, or have a quick flick through the contents. So I started becoming aware of the science and getting worried by it. And I've become increasingly worried by it, and now I've reached the, not just a point of worry, but frank terror, and a feeling that we're probably in the dying throes of a species. As a friend of mine put it, we're probably the only species on the planet ever to have documented its own extinction. And it's happening very, very, very quickly. Now, the trouble is, I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. If I didn't have them, I might just say, well, the human species deserves what it gets. But I've got to do something for them, and it will bite in their lifetime. And I felt that having prepared all the way through, and yes, I flew to Choi Oyu in Tibet a year ago, I felt, though, that it would be hard to stand on that platform and then say, yeah, but it's all right for me to take the flight. Now, I appreciate it's a small thing. I'm not having a go at people who have going to take a trip to Bali, and it's just that for me to stand up and say one thing and then do the other, I thought would be a little bit duplicitous.
It will take individual action at that sort of level, won't it? Anyway, whatever your view, don't forget you can add your thoughts to all of these topics and more on the Guardian Science blog. There's a very healthy debate at the moment there on homeopathy going on. Read what Ben Goldacre and Jeanette Winterson have written on our website and then have your say. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. You'll remember a few weeks ago we interviewed the theoretical physicist Mark Buchanan about social physics. Someone who's also an advocate of that idea is science writer Philip Ball. Now, Margaret Thatcher may famously have said there's no such thing as society, but Phil believes that we modify our behaviour according to what everyone else around us is doing. And he told Science Weekly reporter Tristan Farrow, one of the best places we can observe these physical laws of society is on the beach.
What's happening there is that we tend to maintain a certain distance from people. You know, there's a sort of comfortable distance that we have. And if we're coming down onto a crowded beach and we want to put our towel down somewhere, we're not going to put it, you know, rubbing shoulders with the next person. We're going to find a space that is far enough away from them. As that beach fills up more and more, what tends to happen is that those interactions, that, if you like, that kind of repulsive interaction between people can result in really quite a striking degree of regularity in the spacing of people. So, you know, there's no obvious rule in terms of the way two people interact that will dictate that you will get this sort of regular spacing in a crowd. It's just what comes out from the collective behaviour.
What is underpinning or underlying these collective phenomena? You mentioned the principle of least effort.
Well, this was an idea that an American social scientist named George Kingsley Zipf proposed to explain the statistics that you see in a whole range of social phenomena. And you know, some of the modern examples of these sorts of statistics are the number of different towns around an urban centre of different sizes. You might expect that those numbers will just be pretty much random. So, you know, you'll have towns that have an average size, and then you'll have you know, fewer that are much bigger than that and fewer that are much smaller. In fact, what you see is that there's a quite different statistical distribution, the one that Zipf saw in a whole range of social phenomena. And he wanted to account for this distribution, this non-randomness, in effect, this distribution that comes about from the fact that the things you're looking at aren't independent, aren't growing or behaving independently. And he proposed that you get this sort of statistics when people are behaving according to what they think is going to cost them the least effort. So they, you know, they don't actually know the answer. It's not clear what the answer is, but they subjectively decide behaving this way is going to do that. He had no way of proving that was so, and there's no clear indication that that's really what's going on. But people are now starting to look at and to get some glimpse of the sorts of laws that might underlie these sort of collective behaviours that come about from the way we interact. It's hard to generalise about that, except to say that this kind of situation where you have systems of many if you like, many particles or many entities that are interacting is one that's very familiar to scientists, and it's very familiar in particular to physicists. You know, this is how they think about how matter behaves, that it's a collection of atoms or molecules that are interacting through physical forces with one another. Now, it seems unlikely at first glance that that's going to tell you anything about the way humans behave, but there are analogies to be drawn, or even more than analogies. You know, there are real similarities, that the fact that people do seem to interact by these sort of repulsive and attractive forces. And so it's no surprise, in a sense, that you do, that you will, out of that, you will get the sort of collective behaviours that physicists are familiar with from looking at, from studying the behaviour of inanimate matter.
That was Philip Ball speaking with Tristan Farrow. You can hear the rest of that interview as this week's Science Extra, where we get into all sorts of interesting areas, including philosophy, politics, and even a bit of history. Head back to the blog or iTunes for more. Speaking of group behaviour, we've been rather slack on going public with our feedback over the past few weeks. No real reason. Most of it's been pretty good, actually. Of our interview with Steven Pinker, you know, the one who swore a lot, Westy says,
"That was bloody excellent. Thank you."
Well, Mr. Claw adds,
"My word, Professor Pinker, wash your filthy mouth out. There's something extremely satisfying about academics cursing like dockers. I get it at work all the time."
Moving on to our Visions of the Future podcast with Michio Kaku, Base Island says,
"I disagree with Dr. Kaku's glib idea that 50 years ago sci-fi writers predicted the future and got it wrong, but this time it's scientists, so they'll get it right. In fact, I predict that that prediction will turn out to be the biggest howler of all. Science and technology has a way of taking off in completely unexpected directions. That's what's so fascinating about it. Just a small example. Kaku said in a few years we'll get a CD-ROM with our genetic code. A CD-ROM? In a few years' time, no one will remember what a CD-ROM was."
Exactly. Most of us here don't even know what it is now. Quick word about our Facebook group. Congratulations to Michael Billinger, a listener from Canada, where we're very popular, apparently, who's now become the 666th member of the I Listen to the Guardian Science podcast group. Producer Ben looks after the group, and in recognition of the fact that Michael is both Canadian and in cahoots with Beelzebub, he's conferred him a special officer status. If you want to become number 667, the neighbour of the beast, tell your friends, lovers and colleagues what we get up to every week. Yes, you too could get a truly hilarious title. Anyway, that was quite self-indulgent, wasn't it? Hugh, let's get back to you. We mentioned at the top of the show that you'll be headlining at the RI's, Royal Institutions, rather, Christmas lectures this year with a talk called Science of Survival. That's 5 hours of talking to kids around Christmas time.
Yeah, very scary, isn't it?
How do you feel about that? Is it more terrifying than climbing, the idea of going to Everest?
I'd say it's infinitely the most terrifying thing I think I can remember doing since I had sort of horrible exams as a teenager. I'm absolutely petrified.
Can you give us a sneak preview of what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm trying to explore how it is that humans survive. It's been a fascination of mine for a long time. On intensive care particularly, it can be very deeply embarrassing. You have two patients who look very much the same, and you have no idea of knowing which one's going to live and which one's going to die, and it's almost impossible to know. And indeed, you can have someone, you can go to the relatives and say, "Look, you know, this guy's looking really fine, I'm sure he'll do very well," and then he does you the disservice of dying quite quickly. And someone else where you have the grim talk to relatives and you find the next morning they're up eating chicken and chips, and it is very hard to predict.
Are you going to give these kids nightmares?
No, I hope not. What we've done is assembled a throng of basically mates whose arms I could twist and a few others who've got extraordinary tales of survival. So we're looking at how it was they survived biologically and then what makes them different. So programme one is dealing with, you might expect, lack of oxygen. And so Sandeep Dhillon, who's a good friend, he was the youngest man to climb the Continental Seven Summits, and he's actually climbed Everest twice. And is extraordinary. The higher he goes, the more easy he seems to find it. He sort of just strolls off up the top of mountains without trouble. Programme two is about use of food and starvation. So Mike Stroud's turning up, he who man-hauled colossal
finds,
across Antarctica to the point of...
You're just listing a load of Ian's heroes, basically.
Yeah, he's absolutely terrific. Then we've got others turning up. So we've got a soldier who was involved in a sort of dramatic rescue in Sierra Leone and had to sort of rescue a whole load of people and take them through a jungle for mile upon mile on end. We've got someone who survived extraordinary cold, Jamie Andrew, an extraordinary man. You may even remember the story, year 2000, with his friend. They were climbing a mountain in the Alps and got caught in the most awful and totally unexpected storm. And they were stuck there for 6 days. with in absolutely freezing conditions, wind speeds of 130 kilometres an hour, and he survived that. Another called Chris Moon, who lost his leg in a mine accident, but then managed to run the Marathon des Sables across the hottest desert in the world. So these sorts of individuals, looking at them and what makes them different, because I'm sure as hell that I couldn't survive those sorts of things.
Ian's salivating at the thought of meeting these sorts of people. Sorry, can you invite him to your lectures and sit in between the kids? Yeah. Ian, go on.
My hero, all-time hero has to be Mike Stroud.
Fantastic. But he can't climb mountains.
Well,
he came with us last year.
Okay. We've just knocked him down a little bit of a notch. No, never. I was just interested in whether, I mean, presumably at the root of this, you know, who survives, who doesn't, there's something genetic going on.
There is.
But is it that you can have, you know, two guys that look pretty similar fitness, pretty similar musculature and, you know, all the rest of it, and do two things to them, one will die, one won't?
Well, what we're interested in is doing exactly the same thing to those people. And the mountainside is really, it's a fantastic testbed. So on Choyoyu last year, so this was 8,201 metres, Mike Grocott's the expedition leader and a fabulous expedition leader too. Myself out there doing, you know, leading on some of the science, and our expedition logistics manager, who'd also done a lot of work for Ranulf Fiennes, and that's a guy called Mac. Now, we're almost within a millimetre or two the same height. We're within a gram or two the same weight, to the point where we can swap jackets. And if I come in to do a ward round and forgotten mine, I can borrow Mike's, and Mac can borrow a dinner jacket. And we're almost the same. On the exercise bikes, objectively measuring our fitness before we went out, we were within a whisker of our maximum oxygen consumptions. I mean, a fraction of a percentage point. And what's known as our anaerobic threshold, where you start having to burn fuel without oxygen, was almost the same as well. Yet we go on the hill. Mike Grocott just basically wanders up it. He could have been in the Lake District, honestly. And everyone who's climbed with him says the same thing. He's an elite performer at altitude. I sort of struggled my way up there, but did as well as anyone, I guess. And Mac was completely stuck at by Camp 1. I mean, couldn't go beyond there. Mike Stroud, again, I mean, you could not meet firstly, a nicer guy, but a more motivated, hard as nails, strong, super fit. You know, if anyone was going to get up the hill, it was him. And he couldn't get beyond Camp 1. He was just stopped in his tracks. So it is something else. Mm. And what's the something else?
And you can't predict at all. I mean, is it that some people who are incredibly fit, when they get up to high altitude, they just fall apart, whereas someone who heavily smokes and drinks and eats burgers all their life might be really fine?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's a famous mountain in the past. It was once asked, you know, Mr. Exner, how do you train for climbing Everest? And he says, well, I buy an extra bag of chips on the way back from the pub, you know. You can't tell at all. And weight loss, of course, is a big thing. Being a bit fatter is no bad thing on the hill. But this applies to everything. It applies, for instance, to survival in cold water. It's survival in heat. If the ship goes down, you can look at many classic shipwrecks, apart from the fact, obviously, having no life jacket, not being able to swim would obviously be a slight disadvantage. Amongst other groups, it's very hard to predict who it is that survives and who doesn't, and whether there's such a thing as a will to live. But there clearly is, in my view, a thing called a will to live, and it clearly does make a big difference to survival in a variety of circumstances. But what is that, and how does it work?
We can't let you go without asking you one question. This was reported in the newspapers during the Extreme Everest trip. The doctors and mountain climbers and kind of the heroes that they were, taking blood from each other at high altitudes, they actually saved some lives up there as well, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And I mean, I have to say, I wasn't on Everest this year, having made, as you say, that climate change call for not travelling. The expedition was led by Mike Grocott, who is not only an extraordinarily good scientist and climber, but a very decent man. And all of the people who were with him are of that sort of calibre. And the rules have been set by everyone before they went that first came life, their own and other people's. Second came relationships, that everyone had to come back friends. And thirdly came the science. So it was important to get them in that order. Now, in fact, they were involved in the rescues of two people. And I think those were very informative, because previously people have walked past dying people saying it's impossible to rescue people at that altitude. There's no morality beyond 8,000 metres, this quoted statement, leave them to die. And secondly, by the time you're collapsed and you're scarcely breathing and so forth, you're as good as dead anyway. Well, firstly, that was shown in the rescues in which they're engaged not to be true. So certainly one of those people would have been left to die in the past and was successfully brought down. The second thing which the team tell me was that, of course, very odd situation on the South Col of Everest, you've suddenly got a whole pile of intensive care consultants, which is slightly not unusual.
Not common, is it?
No, but this particularly the woman that was rescued first was brought in, and all the other climbers around took one look at her and said, well, she's dead, isn't she? She's had it. You know, she's had her chips. It's all over. All the doctors who are used to seeing sick people took one look at her and said, oh, she's going to be fine. And she was. And she is completely
good
fine.
News.
You know, she's gone home and is fine. But I have to say, you're quite right. All credit to them, because they were prepared to sacrifice their own chance at the summit to rescue her. And you would never have heard of the story. They'd have been the team that never got to the top. And they were prepared to do that and did it without any question at all. So I think they are extraordinary people. And if there's a story that should come out from Everest, it's, to my view, whether the science is the most important thing, I'm not sure. I think that's, I'm glad you picked up on it. I think they did an extraordinary job and they need commending for it.
Well, we'll leave it on that happy note then. Thanks to everyone in the pod, Ian Sample, David Adam, and of course our special guest, Hugh Montgomery. As we've mentioned, Hugh will be speaking at the Royal Institution's Christmas Lectures next month. We put full details on our blog. You might also like to head to extreme-everest.co.uk for more on his trip to the world's highest peak. That's Extreme with an X, by the way. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I've been Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.